Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Martha Deal, Harriet Williamson, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about Latinos and their political participation, and perhaps talk a little bit about the potential for Latino voters to be an important force in the presidential election 2008. Certainly, it is true that Latino voters have attracted a great deal of attention from party strategists, both on the right and on the left, because Latinos tend to have an interesting mix of political attitudes. Their social conservatism, for example, leads Republicans to think that Latinos could be potential GOP voters. Democrats, however, they come along and say, well, concerns over things like social welfare issues make Latinos a natural constituency for them. So we'll talk a little bit about that this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Gary Segura. He is Associate Professor of American Politics at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, went to school here, got his PhD here. He's also taught at UC Davis, at Claremont Graduate University, and University of Iowa. And he's particularly interested in the accessibility of government and politics to America's growing Latino minority. In addition, he was involved in the Latino National Survey. He was the co-principal investigator of the Latino National Survey. This was a national poll involving 8,600 Latino residents of the U.S. that was conducted in the fall and winter 2005-2006. And this was really the first time since the late 80s that someone had tried to do something this comprehensive and talking with a variety of people about their attitudes about politics, their interest in politics, what issues they thought were important. And we'll talk about some of that, too. Questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here you want to pick up the telephone, give us a call, be involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
I appreciate it. I think it might be interesting to talk a little bit about the Latino National Survey. As I said, it's not really new anymore, but I think it's significant for a variety of reasons, and maybe the big reason is that, in fact, it is the first time since the late 80s that anyone tried to really do this, do a comprehensive look at Latinos in the United States. And I think, as I remember back to talking to people about that survey, that probably one of the most important things, the big headlines to come out of it was, don't look at Latinos as being some kind of monolithic group, because they're not. You got to take it apart, and you got to treat people as individuals, and you got to look at where they are and where they came from, because attitudes, party affiliation, all sorts of things like that really varies.
That was definitely true in 1989 when the LNPS was conducted. And one of the reasons we wanted to revisit this set of questions and many others is the demographic change. So the Latino population has essentially doubled in size since 1989. Half of all the people over the age of 18, who were the people who could conceivably be called into our survey, were not here or not yet 18 at the time that the last survey was run. So we have a really new population here, and we don't know much about them. Mm-hmm. And the question that you raise is, can you look at Latinos as a monolithic group? And in 1989, the answer was clearly no. Here we are 18 years later, and the answer is, well, maybe. And it depends on how you want to look at it. But there is this this growing sense that we find in the Latino community of what we academicians term as pan-ethnicity, the idea that Mexican-Americans, Puerto Ricans, Cuban-Americans, Dominicans, Salvadorans, etc., actually see themselves as part of a larger group that we could understand to be Hispanic or Latino, which clearly was not the case 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this idea that there is a Hispanic or a Latino social group. They could be identified, that understood that they were part of a group. That's a relatively recent phenomenon, something they did not find in 89, but that we do find in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Well, among the things that you ask people things like, how do you identify yourself? Mm-hmm. Are you likely to use a term like Hispanic or a term like Latino? And then you ask questions about, people identifying themselves as Americans. This is one of those things that now, with all of the heated debate surrounding immigration issues, seems to be one of the things that people wrestle with and argue about, and a concern that many people have about the degree to which Latinos, whether they've been here for a while or whether they're relative newcomers, identify with America, American tradition, American values, to the extent to which they identify themselves as Americans.
Sure.
Now, how does that sit up against this maybe increasing tendency to see oneself, even people from diverse backgrounds, as part of this sort of larger group?
Yeah, we did something kind of experimental in the survey, which is we asked the question about how people view themselves. We asked those questions separately. Mm-hmm. So we asked how well does the term American apply to you? People could say very strongly or somewhat strongly. And then we asked the same question about their national origin group. So how strongly does the term Cuban describe you? Or Mexican or Salvadoran or whatever the appropriate group was. And the third question was, how strongly does Latino or Hispanic, whichever one they preferred, describe you? And what we find, because we asked the question separately and we vary the order, so each respondent got it in a different order. We didn't always sort of cue one thing ahead of the others. What we found is that sizable majorities of the respondents felt somewhat or very strongly about all three. And I think the reason is that identity does not require us to make those sort of trade-offs. If I asked you, are you a man or an American, that's a nonsensical question to you because you're clearly equally both in a sense. Are you Catholic or are you an American? That's a nonsensical question because Catholic is not understood as being somehow or another distinct from being American. So if I ask you, are you Hispanic or are you an American, to a significant number of our respondents, that's a nonsensical question because I could say, are you Hispanic or are you Irish? I could say, are you Hispanic or are you Japanese? But to say, are you Hispanic or are you American, those things are not necessarily antonyms. You can be both, just as you can be female, Catholic, Republican, suburbanite, churchgoer, bowler, and bow and arrow enthusiast. I mean, we don't have to choose our identities as single entities. We can be a variety of things at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in going, and again, a sense, jumping back a little bit, because, again, as you say, the thing that I remember having talked with people about the big survey that was done in the late 80s was that people tended, rather than identifying as Hispanics or Latinos or Hispanic Americans, that they had seemed to have a strong identification with their place of origin.
And that remains to be, that's true.
So people were saying, rather than saying, broadly speaking, they identified themselves as an Hispanic American, maybe they say, well, I am a Mexican American, I'm a Cuban American, I'm
sure.
Guatemalan, I'm Puerto Rican, whatever it is, that they have this real strong identification with the place from which they came.
Sure. And what's changed about that is, so back in 1989, if we said you must pick one, you must pick American or you must pick Hispanic or Latino or you must pick your national origin group, mm-hmm. 70% would pick their national origin group. I'm Cuban. I'm Mexican. I'm Puerto Rican. What's happened today is that if we ask that question again, about the same number of people said Hispanic or Latino as said their national origin group. And that's dramatically different than it was 20 years ago. And that's what I was talking about earlier when I said there's this growing sense of pan-ethnicity. That would not have happened back in 89, but it happens today.
So what are some ideas that people have perhaps about why that has happened? And there perhaps does seem to be a kind of a strength and an emerging idea of a pan-Latino identity.
A couple things have happened since then. The first thing that's happened is that there's been a bit of diversification of the Hispanic population with respect to national origin. So even in Los Angeles, which we think of as largely a Mexican Latino environment, there are large numbers of Salvadorans. There are large numbers of Nicaraguans. and Guatemalans. And so they find themselves interacting on a daily basis with this 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is the Mexican population, which is the huge percentage of Latinos there. Mm-hmm. And so what emerges from them having to negotiate a sort of social space for themselves there is the creation of this pan-ethnic identity. No, I'm not Mexican, but I'm still Latino. And the Mexican leadership themselves have in fact moderated or altered their language to speak in these terms. The second thing that's happened, so basically multiple national origin groups coming together is what's really really driven this. And the history, by the way, the term Latino and Hispanic really, the term Latino especially, really took hold in, of all places, Chicago in the 1980s. That was the only place where 20 years ago you would see this pan-ethnic identity take place. But that was because Chicago's population was at that time approximately half Puerto Rican, half Mexican in its Latino subpopulation. Today it's overwhelmingly Mexican. So that's changed. So whenever you have multiple national origin groups coming together, you get this pan-ethnic thing. The second thing is that you have a rather rapid expansion of the Latino population around the country. So that there are now a large number of Mexicans in New York City. There are a large number, and it's driven largely by Mexican immigration. There's a large number of Mexicans in Florida. So the frequency, the number of places with which you have different ethnic groups coming into contact, whether it's Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and Mexicans in New York City, or Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and Mexicans in Florida, that the number of places where the intersection of these different national origin groups takes place makes the pan-ethnic identity more useful and more descriptive of what people's political and social life is all about.
Yeah. Our guest, again, just to introduce for this hour, Focus 580, Gary Segura. He is Associate Professor of American Politics at University of Washington.
I have to correct that for my mother. Yeah. I'm a full professor now.
Oh, well.
And this is important to my mom, who kept asking me 17 years after finishing graduate school, are you a professor yet? Are you a professor yet? I said, well, yes, I'm a professor as my profession, but my rank is associate professor. Well, no, now I'm a full professor.
Well, so. This needs to be acknowledged. This is not a small thing. He is a professor of American politics at University of Washington, and he's a graduate of the University of Illinois. He got his PhD here. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk, in fact, tonight at 7, is that right? In room 180 of Bevere Hall, taking a look at Latino political incorporation and their potential involvement in the 2008 presidential election, sponsored in among other things, by the Latino Studies Program. So he's here visiting the campus. This is open to anyone who is interested in stopping by. So
public lecture.
Public lecture. We do have a caller to bring into the conversation. Others are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody here on calling on a cell phone. Line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
You know what? I'm kind of interested in getting into the political spectrum myself, just so you know. I'm thinking about going back to school for that. I'm 51. I don't know if I can hang in there that long, but that's just one of my fields, what you're in, that I want to take up studying. But anyway, you were asking these questions, and I'm a first-generation American. My folks and everybody were born in Amsterdam and other parts in Holland. And the question you brought up was are you an American? Are you are you a Dutch? And somebody had asked this before, and the first thing they say is, I'm American. Okay, and the reason I'm throwing this out is that they're proud to be an American. Why? Because they came over here, they got all the papers, they did what they needed to do to become an American. Okay, I bet you when you ask Hispanics this, same question, are they going to say they're American or Hispanic? They're probably, you know, I'm curious to see what the outcome is, because right now with the rift going on and everybody looking for, you know, illegals in a way to fix this problem, they might be afraid to answer these questions for, you know, fear of reprisals. Is this true?
Generally, we haven't had much problem with that. And there's a number of techniques that you can use in survey research to try to get people to answer truthfully. And, of course, the first technique is that we promise each of our respondents confidentiality and anonymity so that they know that they can't be connected to their specific answer. But you raise a very important question, which is how do people born in another country, how do they acquire that sense of Americanness? And in fact, we have different experiences in our history. So if you go back, for example, and look at, say, European migration in the latter part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century, the whole Ellis Island experience. In America today, particularly as we deal with the question of Hispanic immigration, there is a tendency, I think, to sort of romanticize that period and to say, you know, the poor and the tired come through the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island and you know, took on their American identity and life was good. In fact, the reality was a little bit more complex than that. So, for example, the research suggests that of the Italians, for example, who immigrated to the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century, about 45% of them ultimately went home. They ultimately went back to Italy. And so this notion of circular migration is not a recent phenomenon. It's something that took place even in the sort of big, you know, big immigrant days of the turn of the century. And the reason is because you find yourself at sea in a culture and an environment that you may not fully understand. And when we look at how Latino immigrants identify themselves, a lot depends on whether or not they have become U.S. citizens. So people who become U.S. citizens are far more likely to identify themselves as American. A lot depends on if you identify or you're asking someone for a cultural identity versus a political identity. And it's not a distinction we make a lot in the United States, but it's meaningful to people. So that's a change. And then a third issue to think about is how they feel they've been greeted. And there is a very long scholarship tradition in political science looking at how American identity has changed over the course of our 235 years or so of existence, where in fact what it means to be American has actually changed quite dramatically since the founding, and changed in ways that have been very specific about who's included and who's not included. So, for example, if you were an immigrant from Asia or China, from China or Japan, prior to the early 1950s, you could not become a citizen of the United States. We had naturalization laws that racially excluded people. Those people might not have answered American either, but there's a very good reason why that's the case. If we have someone who's an undocumented alien, strictly speaking, they're not an American, not legally, not culturally, not in any way other than that they're working here. So we wouldn't have expected them to answer that they're an American. That would actually be an incorrect response in some respect. So I think
the only other thing I want to throw back at you, too, I mean, I know California has turned into basically Hispanic now, and I think even a third of that is Orientals or Asian. You see, like when my folks came over, it was Europeans. Now I think it's been mainly, like you said, is Spanish and Puerto Rican and whatnot and Orientals. Is that true? I'll get off. And thanks, guys. Great show.
Sure.
Sure. Thanks for your question. Actually, California and Texas have joined Hawaii as the only states in the United States where Anglos are not an outright majority. So in California, about 35% of the state's population is Latino or Hispanic. And then African-Americans and Asian-Americans and indigenous populations, natives, make up another 16 or so percent. So that about 51% of California's population is non-white, depending on how we define that term, whereas a slight minority are Anglos. In Texas, you have the same experience taking place. Hawaii is different, of course. Hawaii is, you know, has an indigenous Hawaiian population, in addition, a very large Asian American population, so that Hawaii has been majority non-white for a very long time, including, of course, when it was an island nation of its own.
I sort of feel compelled, though, again here to remind people of a couple of things. One would be that the majority of Latinos living in the United States are legal. Are you legally?
Well, the majority are citizens,
and they're citizens. They're officially Americans. Number two is that the very significant increase that we've seen in the Latino segment of the population is not a result of people coming here. It's a result of people being born here.
Yeah, that's an important point. Native-born live births exceed immigration as a contributor to the net population growth. And in terms of who is or who is not a citizen, it's important to draw a line at that age of 18. Because it turns out the Census Bureau does this, and you can see some very interesting patterns. So if you look at adults, About 60% are foreign-born and about 40% are native-born. And of the foreign-born population, about a third of them have naturalized to U.S. citizens. So among adults, you've got about half citizens and half non-citizens, some of whom are legitimate immigrants and some of whom are undocumented immigrants. But among the children under the age of 18, the Census Bureau reports that 86% of those are U.S. citizens by birth, mm-hmm. and what they're native-born, and probably another percentage or two are citizens by naturalization. So when you look at a Latino child, the odds are 9 out of 10 that you're looking at a U.S. citizen, which means, in terms of political terms, that if no additional immigrants cross the border, if no additional immigrants naturalize to U.S. citizenship, the Latino electorate will still double in the next 18 years without any immigration at all. So it's important to make that distinction because, you know, we frequently hear about immigrants in schools and things like that. In fact, the vast majority of Latino children in school are U.S. children going to U.S. schools.
Mm-hmm. I guess one other thing, and I'm sure I know that assimilation is a contentious term. I don't know how you feel about it, but that if sort of setting that aside, if you take a look at the experiences and the attitudes of, say, within families across generations, starting with people who were newcomers and then they had children here and then their children had children here and so forth, it doesn't seem to take very long before, by just about any measure that we would want to pick, you have people who indeed are assimilated. They would consider them, you know, whatever kind of ethnic identification they have, would consider themselves Americans. And this idea that people might tend to propagate that somehow Latinos are living apart, or that they are a separate group within American society, it at least in families across time, it just doesn't hold up.
Right. There's the two measures that are most of interest here are, well, there's a variety, but the two that most people spend a lot of time focusing on is language acquisition, right, and residential segregation. Mm-hmm. And the language acquisition question is an important one because I think the popular perception is that Latino immigrants don't speak English, and God darn it, we wish they would just, you know, get around to learning English. Yeah. And there's a bit of misperception taking place there. And the reason is that when you see some number of Latino immigrants, you're seeing people who, some of whom have been here 10 years, and they might be living cheek to jowl with someone who's been here 10 months. And so those are very different experiences. And so the way you have to study this is to look at the time since first migration to the United States, when does English acquisition take place? And it turns out that after about 10 years in the U.S., more than half of all adult immigrants to the United States are English fluent. And by the time you get to, which is roughly comparable to what you had in the late 19th, early 20th century, by the time you get to the first generation U.S. born, so children born to foreign-born parents, they are English fluent by the second grade, effectively, and live their lives primarily in English. By the time you get to the third generation, the second generation born in the United States, they are not only English dominant, but many of them lose their skills to speak Spanish, or they speak only household Spanish. I am an example. My Spanish is terrible, and I'll admit that up front. And so they speak household Spanish. They don't, you know, all of their learning, all of their education has been in English. And when they think of complex things associated with work, with politics, with organizations, with social life, it's all in English.
Mm-hmm. At our midpoint here, let me just again introduce quickly our guest, Gary Segura. He is a professor of American politics at the University of Washington, Seattle. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, where he got his PhD, to give a talk. We'll be doing that tonight at 7 in room 180 of Bevere Hall, and it's open to the public. Anybody who is interested, he'll be talking about Latino political incorporation and the idea that, indeed, Latinos could be an important force in American politics and generally and specifically looking at the 2008 presidential election. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Line 1 is next. This is someone listening this morning in Charles. Hello.
Yes. A question. You mentioned Hawaii.
Yep.
Which was part of the question I was going to ask. And policy, And what is the policy that denies Mexico statehood and gives it to Hawaii?
That's an interesting question.
I think I know, but
yeah. Well, the historical record with respect to Hawaii is not a pretty one, in fact. So essentially, American plantation owners, pineapple plantation owners, in effect staged a coup against the Hawaiian royal regime, monarchy, and Hawaii was incorporated into the United States in that way, and it achieved its statehood some considerable time later. Part of Mexico, of course, are U.S. states. So in 1848, as a result of the Mexican-American War, approximately half of Mexico's landmass was incorporated into the United States, and that now encompasses the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, part of Colorado, Utah, Nevada, and of course, California. Now, there is no provision with which I'm familiar that would allow the United States to somehow or another annex an international regime like the nation state of Mexico. I think a more interesting or a more curious question is the correct question of Puerto Rican status, because Puerto Rico, of course, has been under U.S. control since the Spanish-American War in 1898. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens by statute, the Jones Act of 1912 and 1917 amendment. And so the question is, why is Puerto Rico not a state or an independent country?
The Marianas Islands.
Or the Marianas. I mean, the United States has a variety of possessions. And then the question is, what would the process be to achieve statehood? You know, in Puerto Rico, that's always been a divisive question. I know less, I have to say, about the American Pacific possessions, Guam and the Marianas and Samoa and whatnot. But in the case of Puerto Rico, it's been something that's been quite difficult for Puerto Ricans themselves to come to grips with. So support for independence on the island is very, very low. It's never polled more than 10% of the vote, and usually considerably less than that. But support for statehood versus sort of keeping things the way they are, Commonwealth status, is almost evenly divided. And so they've had a number of plebiscites in Puerto Rico on the question of statehood. Statehood has never won, but it's always lost by 1 percentage point, 2 percentage points, and independence has never been a real option. There was talk among the Puerto Rican statehood party of pulling the Tennessee trick. And Tennessee, when it first applied for admission to the Union in the late 1700s, was being resisted. And so they went ahead and they formed a state constitution and they elected representatives and senators and they sent them to Washington, or actually Washington was just being built at that time, but they sent them to the Capitol and they slept in the halls of the Capitol building until they were admitted and allowed to take their seats in Congress. And so the statehood party in Puerto Rico actually threatened to go ahead and create a state government and elect representatives and senators and let them sleep in the halls of Congress until they were admitted. They haven't followed through on that threat. But the question of why that's the case, I think in part it's because the Puerto Ricans themselves are not certain in which direction they'd like to go.
Well, the whole thing, in my view, decries the reality. I mean, I understand capitalism and foreign policy about air bases and ports and such as that are in the interest of the U.S. bourgeoisie who control the world, as well as if it is cheaper to have someone that you possess, a possession, then you don't have to do much for them. But that's the oxymoron of Mexico. I mean, here it's attached right there at the end of California. It goes right down through all the little nations there. And to think that... I think I understand that they don't want the responsibility of it. So it's a cheap labor force, illegals, legals, generational, as you've said. Well, I mean, wherein and how is it possible that we can get some humanity into our foreign policy and our own policies here at home and around the world?
Well, I think you raise an important question. I think the question is, do we treat people with dignity? And folks who are advocates on the part of of the immigrant population, particularly the people who come to work in really miserable industries like poultry packing and meat packing, where the average number of days to your first injury sustained on the job is literally measured in tens of days because it's such an ugly experience. These folks need to be treated, I need to be treated with greater dignity and greater respect, and I think that we need to have a process that recognizes the economic needs of the United States and the economic needs of the migrants. This discussion we hear recently of guest worker programs, I find deeply disturbing, and that's, you know, my commentary. I'm not me as a social scientist, but me as a person. And it's deeply disturbing because the history of the United States, as a previous caller raised, is one of people coming to the United States, working hard, and becoming part of our society. And now suddenly we're going to have a program where people can come to the United States, work hard, and then when you're done working hard, could you please leave? And some folks find that, and I'm one of them, find that a little bit of a betrayal of the American national dream.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I have some other series I want to go next to talk with somebody on Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. What do you have in the study? Did you bring out how many, what percentage of them married outside of their ethnic group at all or not?
We did, in fact, and I actually don't have those numbers directly in front of me, but I have a slide that I could show at tonight's talk. I just don't have it in front of me. But it actually the markers of assimilation go more or less like we saw in the 19th and 20th century migration. So first generation tend to marry within the group. Second generation, you have about a 70% in-group marriage. And by the time you get to the third and fourth generation, the rate of in-group marriage is only in the low 50s, meaning 40% or more of Latinos are marrying individuals outside that category. They're largely Anglos, but in some instances African-Americans or Asians. So an out-group marriage is a traditional measure of incorporation or acculturation in the society. So Latino rates of out-group marriage are actually quite high.
Well, I would also think that the variation, too, is greater among maybe in terms of Mexican versus other groups, wouldn't it be, or not?
That depends. That depends on the size of the population. It depends on where people are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you live, for example, in metropolitan Los Angeles, out-group marriage may actually be somewhat less frequent simply because there are so many Latinos that, say, for example, if you're in high school and your high school is virtually entirely Hispanic, then chances are the girl or gal you take to the prom is Hispanic. If you are in a place like Iowa, for example, where there's been some recent growth in Latino migration, there's a mixture of people. Most people in your high school are probably not Hispanic. And so part of that's going to depend on where you live. And then you suggested that there's a national origin group difference, and that could well be the case as well. So, for example, you might get more out-group marriage among Mexican-Americans living in Texas, for example, than you would in California. Or you might get more out-group marriage on the part of Mexicans than on the part of Puerto Ricans, for example. I don't actually know the answer to that, and I would have to go back and look at the data to see what the trends are in that direction.
And then just finally, I think what are issues that are important of importance to these various groups? And I'll just hang up and listen in.
Thanks. That's a great question. And the answer in for folks who study Latinos in politics has really been the same for quite some time, which is the three issues that most drive Latinos are education, jobs and economic development, and crime. Education is always the number one issue that Latinos identify as being important to their community because they recognize that education is the principal path to social mobility in the United States. Crime is not surprising. When you live in economically depressed environments, you're likely to see more than your share of crime. It's interesting, you know, the Lou Dobbs types and the folks talking about undocumented immigration talk a lot about a criminal element. In fact, the statistics suggest that undocumented aliens are less likely to commit crimes than Americans are, and the reason is that they don't want to have any contact with the system for obvious reasons, and so they're actually not. But they are more likely to be victims of crimes because they don't want to call the police, and so in fact, crime is a big issue for all Latinos and especially for undocumented aliens. And then the third issue is jobs, and that's, you know, education, jobs, and crime, and sounds like a pretty sort of mainstream agenda. And in fact, when Cruz Bustamante first ran for lieutenant governor in California, and after he'd been Speaker of the Assembly, he was frequently quoted in the media saying the Latino agenda is the American agenda. Now, one thing has changed recently, and the thing that has changed is the Iraq War. And the Iraq War, not unlike other Americans, the Iraq War registers as the most important national issue among all Latinos when you ask them, you know, what's the most important issue facing the country. Mm. When you ask them what's the most important issue facing Latinos, you get education, jobs, and crime. But when you ask them about the country, Iraq leapfrogs to the top.
So obviously here in Latinos, we have a growing and increasingly important segment of the population here, something that has not escaped the notice of the Republican and Democratic parties. And as I said at the beginning, because of Latinos, their identification with an interesting spectrum of issues, here we have both parties thinking, well, here now there's fertile ground for us to attract voters. If you ask Latinos, if you'd say, are you a Republican, what would best sort of describe you, or, you know, what your political philosophy? Would it be A, Republican, B, Democrat, C, Independent? D, you know, you could do an other, give them some other kind of choice. What kind of answers do you get back?
Overwhelmingly Democratic, probably 3-1 in terms of party identification. But a huge portion who would describe themselves as independent or undecided. And there's a big sort of asterisk next to that, which is Cuban Americans are far more likely to identify as Republican than any other group. Republicans are still a majority among Cubans, but not like they once were. So we find second and third generation Cubans acting sort of more and more like other Latinos and less mm-hmm. like the Cuban immigrants who came to the United States in the 60s after the Castro regime. So there is a weakening of those ties. So overwhelmingly the Democratic Party, but that does not necessarily mean that Latinos don't vote Republican. And in fact, I think it's one of the strategic advantages that Latinos have, if only the Latino leadership can figure out how to use it. And that is that unlike any other group in the United States, any other demographic group you can think of, Latinos are a very large swing constituency. So by some estimates, as much as 44% of Latinos voted for George Bush in 2004. Those numbers are probably inflated. It was probably closer to 40. There's some exit poll reasons why that might have been wrong. But still, a sizable portion, whereas only under 28% voted for Bob Dole in 1996. So you have potentially as much as a 16-point variation in the partisan vote and presidential vote of a single demographic group. Anglos, whites, do not vary their vote like that. African Americans do not vary their vote like that. So if you're talking about a large constituency where you could conceivably change someone's mind and make someone who previously voted Republican vote Democrat, make someone who previously voted Democrat vote Republican, Latinos are the largest bloc going. And that puts them at a very interesting position. The GOP has long seen Latinos as a potential recruiting target because Latinos hold very conservative positions on what's come to be understood as family values, issues of abortion and homosexual rights. The problem the GOP has had there is twofold. The first is that those are not the most important issues for Latinos. It's all education, crimes, and jobs. And they find the Democrats more reliable on that and more credible. A claim based entirely on values votes are not likely to get you very far. And the second is that Latinos perceive the immigrant baiting as an attack on Latinos. And so George Bush was very successful in reaching out to Latinos because he sincerely, I whatever you think of the president, I think his interest in attracting Latino votes was sincere. He sincerely reached out to try to bring Latinos into his coalition and succeeded to some degree. But that doesn't mean that every member of his party did. So when Congressman Sensenbrenner wrote his bill in December of 2005, which led to all the protests and whatnot, that bill was seen as an attack. And when GOP strategists tell you, well, you know, many Latinos have concerns about immigration and so, you know, we can be tough on immigration and that doesn't mean we don't like Latino voters. It's important to remember that virtually every Latino voter is directly connected to the immigration experience, even if they themselves are not immigrants. So first of all, you have mixed status families. You have people who are U.S. citizens who are married to or children of immigrants. And many of US, many Latino U.S. citizens have parents who are foreign-born or grandparents who are foreign-born, so that somewhere in the neighborhood of about 87% of the Latino electorate is within two generations of the immigration experience, and probably in the 60% range are within one generation of the immigrant experience. So while they themselves might not be the target of an anti-immigrant policy, they still sympathize in that respect and don't like it. And so I think that the GOP has hurt themselves with this rhetoric.
I think it's interesting the way the Republicans have indeed been divided because, as you point out, it was the president who was advancing this what essentially amounted to a guest worker program. And it was his fellow Republicans in Congress, particularly in the House, who were the ones who were saying, no, that's not what we need to do. We need to be tough on illegal immigration. We need to bolster border security. And his fellow Republicans in the House would not support him on the policy that he'd been. And he'd been advocating this for some time, even before it became such a hot issue, I think.
That's right. And this issue does a good job of demonstrating the difference in America between what national polls look like and what primary electorates look like for members of Congress who have to go back and face voters in their own district. So the national polls show some pretty strong consensus. So you hear on the nightly news that immigration is a divisive issue and that the American public is deeply divided over the question. Well, in fact, that's not true. If you look at any poll taken, Gallup, Roper, any of the major polling organizations, CBS News, New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, et cetera, you'll find that when given the range of potential policy options with amnesty at one end and, you know, making all illegals felons at the other, and with two middle positions, one is a guest worker program that doesn't lead to citizenship and the other is a guest worker program that leads to citizenship. You get somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 65% of the American population who, when given those four choices, choose the guest worker program that leads to an earned path to citizenship. That's a huge majority. In a society where we decide national elections on 1% of the vote, to have 63% of Americans agree on anything is actually pretty shocking. And so we actually have consensus in this country on what the immigration policy should be. Strict, tough border enforcement accompanied with an adjustment of status for the folks who are here that allows them to pay fines, pay back taxes, and earn their way towards a path to citizenship. That's more or less what the Senate bill was trying to do that ultimately was defeated. However, that's not necessarily the views of the primary constituents of individual members of Congress. So each member of Congress doesn't go home to face a congressional district that looks exactly like America. In fact, they go home to face a congressional district that's either very liberal and very Democratic or very conservative and very Republican. And so they have to play to that electorate. Members of the House of Representatives represent a very small sliver of the country. They represent this one little congressional district, and they have to respond to that opinion. And the opponents of immigration are very, very organized, and they're very outspoken, and they are very passionate, and they have interesting voice representation in folks like Lou Dobbs, for example. And for the record, I don't have leprosy, nor does anyone I know have leprosy, just to respond to Lou. But with this in mind, it's very good politics for people from very conservative districts to play this kind of game. That doesn't mean it helps the president, but it helps them.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Gary Segura, is professor of American politics at University of Washington, Seattle. We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have a caller here who's been patient, and we'll get right to them. Ann Urbana, line one. Hello.
My question was going to be, do you think there is actually a Latino bloc? And then the second, which you kind of have explained, and then I wondered if Latinos are particularly interested in Governor Bill Richardson, who, although he was born in the States, was reared in Mexico. His mother is a Latina, and I'm surprised that I'm not seeing more about Latinos gravitating toward him, and I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. In terms of Latinos being a bloc, I suggested earlier, I think that I would predict about 70% of Latinos will vote Democratic in November 2008's elections. It could be even higher given the current environment. That block has different effects in different states, and it just depends on whether or not the states are competitive or not. With respect to Bill Richardson, he has run kind of a stealth Latino campaign. That is that there's a he doesn't attract much votes among Latinos, I got to tell you. So we did some polling. I did some polling in Nevada and California in a proprietary effort, and we asked Latinos who they were considering in the Democratic primary, and their overwhelming preference was for Hillary Clinton. And Bill Richardson frequently placed he generally placed third. Senator Obama was second, and in some instances actually placed fourth. And part of the reason is a lot of Latinos don't know that Bill Richardson's Latino. And Bill Richardson has really tried to do this sort of stealth campaign. Let me give you an example. So he obviously sees that there's some electoral downside to being too closely identified with Latino interest. On the same hand, he clearly wants Latino support. So there was a televised debate on Univision, which is the largest Spanish language television network in the United States. And the debate was conducted in English. And then each of the responses was translated into Spanish for the audience. When the questioner asked their question of him in Spanish, he started to reply in Spanish and was corrected and told that he had to speak in English because that was the rules for all the candidates. Well, his attempt to reply to that question in Spanish was a message. It was a telegraph to the Latino voters. But it was a subtle one, and it was not one that he really has not run as an aggressively Latino candidate. And some would argue that Senator Obama has not run aggressively as an African American candidate. That there are political downsides to that, and that racial identity kind of cuts both ways in the electoral environment.
Mm. I'm interested in to the extent that you can say something about this, how people, Latinos, feel about being approached, in a sense, as a block, as Latinos, and particularly when we have candidates who are not Latinos showing up and speaking Spanish. Does that impress people, or do people think, okay, we get what's going on here. You don't need to do that.
Well, my favorite joke about this was that when President Bush started speaking Spanish on the campaign trail in 2000, one Hispanic commentator said that his Spanish is about as good as his English, which makes him bi-illiterate. And I think that that's maybe a little unfair. But it is the case that Hispanics generally like voting for Hispanic candidates. And you know, on our poll, we asked them, how important is it? And people do like having Hispanic candidates to choose. And they do like candidates who speak Spanish. But speaking Spanish is, I think, a considerably smaller impact than actually someone who's co-ethnic. So if you are a Mexican-American voting in a state legislative election, for example, in Arizona, and there's a Mexican-American on the ballot, there's a reason that you might want to identify with that person and vote. If it's an Anglo speaking Spanish, it's less clear what that ability to speak Spanish is. In political science, we refer to all this stuff as sort of symbolic politics. So speaking Spanish is a subtle way of conveying that I agree with you, or I see the world the way you do. And the most famous example of this going badly is told in a work that a famous political scientist wrote about symbolic politics. And the example was Gerald Ford, in attempting to reach out to Hispanic voters during the 1976 Republican primary season, was handed a tamale to eat at a Hispanic cultural festival in, I believe it was in San Antonio, but I don't recall for sure. But anyway, he didn't realize that he was supposed to unwrap the corn husk off of the tamale. So he actually bit into the thing with the corn husk on it. So he was attempting to send a positive symbol that he was sympathetic to Hispanic culture and whatnot. And instead, he committed a faux pas. So usually these cultural things are symbols. They're a way to sort of show the community a level of respect, interest, agreement, etc., but they don't always work as effectively as the candidates might like them to.
We're coming down to the point where we have just a minute or two left. If you ask Latinos where it is they get their information about politics, one of the things I'm curious about is the power of Spanish language media and just how important that is.
Spanish language media is profoundly important. It's profoundly important in a couple of different ways. The first is that the vast majority of Latinos in the United States, even second generation Latinos, get their primary news in Spanish from Univision or local affiliates thereof, or Telemundo as well. So that's one big issue. The second issue is the issue of Spanish language radio. And the immigrant rights marches, which you saw in March, April, and May of 2006, were hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of these major cities. There is a very strong indication that Spanish language radio made that happen, that there were nationally prominent DJs whose shows are aired on multiple radio stations who really called for people to come out to the streets. And especially when you're trying to mobilize young people, in some respects, you know, getting to them through the radio is in fact, it's kind of old fashioned in American in politics. No offense to the radio listeners since we're on the radio, but it's kind of an old fashioned way to appeal to voters. And yet it was a mass mobilization technique that had a huge impact. So I think Spanish language media is an important way to reach the Hispanic population. And I don't think it's a particularly well tapped method. So both parties could maybe learn from that.
Mm, okay. And again, just to touch on 2008, the potential here, you see the potential here for Latino voters to be significant?
I think I'm going to talk, this is primarily what I'm going to talk about tonight at 7 o'clock. I think if Latino voters are going to be significant, they're going to be significant primarily in five states. They're going to be significant in Florida. And essentially Cubans have decided the last several national elections. They're going to be significant in Colorado and New Mexico and Nevada. These are states that are undergoing a significant political transformation, having been Republican for the last several elections. And they could be significant in Arizona. Arizona is a little bit tougher not to crack. But essentially these are places where Hispanic populations have grown dramatically. Hispanic voter registration has grown dramatically, and the state's already tending away from its Republican roots and into the Democratic column. So if you are a strategic Democratic candidate, you're going to flood the Southwest with airwaves. Mm.
Well, at that, we must finish because here we're at the end of the time. However, if you'd like to hear more on this very subject from our guest, Gary Segura, he'll be talking tonight at 7 o'clock, room 180 Bevere Hall on the U of I campus, open to the public, and anyone who's interested should feel welcome to stop by. Gary is a professor of American politics at University of Washington in Seattle. Thanks very much.
I was glad to be here.